we need to really enlarge that scope of how we think about climate action. It's not only about the things that you do to reduce your own carbon footprint. It's about how do you try to bring us, the whole of society, onto this transition where we think about climate change not as a threat that is going to kill us all, but as something that we are tackling with all of our might, as a group of people, as a society.
You're listening to Climate Curious, a podcast for people who care about the world but find the current conversation about climate change confusing, boring, or scary. Okay, so welcome. Hello, Mariam.
Hi, Ben.
How are you today?
I think like a lot of people, maybe people recording won't know, but we're recording this 2 days after the US election. So we're still in a bit of a anxious state, those of us who've been
stupor
following it. So I've had a couple of late nights falling asleep in front of the telly, trying to watch returns come in. Been doing this since the year 2000, Ben. Where were you in 2000?
Wow. I was, where was I in 2000? I was 10. I was playing with Beyblades. I was living my dream. I was watching cartoons, I think, watching Dexter's Lab.
I was watching the election. I had my election map. I was colouring in all the states. I mean, I was in my senior year of high school, so I wasn't like too colouring in the states.
But, yeah. Not too carefully.
No. I'm still here this year doing it. And so I'm actually really excited that we're speaking to this guest when we are, given his area of expertise.
Yeah, I think that this is... do you know what? I feel like... okay, so let me be honest. I have a small insecurity which is cropping up for me because I feel like increasingly... well, not even increasingly. I just feel like every time we talk to someone, they're really, really smart. And I don't know if I'm like... if I'm even understanding. So today, more so, I might ask loads of questions about like really basic things, but I think that that's important because if I don't understand, I really want to understand. But I'm really looking forward to this.
So let me introduce Dr. Chris de Meyer. He is a neuroscientist at King's College London, and his work really focuses and looks at polarization and attitudes, but very specifically around climate change. So I'm really excited to have him joining us today. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, Mariam. Hi, Ben.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Like Mariam, a bit tired from sitting in front of the screen too much for the last couple of days.
Oh, I can imagine.
But it is starting to look better. So starting to feel a little bit better than I was yesterday, I think.
We're all on the hopeful train. Even Ben's journey in this podcast has been us trying to make him feel more confident and more hopeful, and so we do a little check-in and know
where's the... every episode, how far have I moved away from despair? And it's gradual. We're getting there. It's good.
Yeah, I can help with that today. Hopefully I can help with that a little.
Hopefully. I need to ask you a question before we start, actually. And the first question is, I realized when we chatted briefly before that I pretended to know what a neuroscientist is. And actually, I have no idea. And when I hear the phrase neuroscientist, I think brain surgeon. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily the same thing. So what is a neuroscientist?
Well, neuroscientists look indeed at brains, but only some of us open skulls and look inside at what there's actually in. So I'm not one of them. I'm not a brain surgeon. I am sort of like a general neuroscientist who looks at tries to understand how the brain works through a number of different types of doing experiments, and that's been part of my work for a number of years now.
So, Chris, what does neuroscience have to do with climate change?
That's a very good question, because on the surface it might not have much to do with it. But if you think about climate change or the changes that are happening in the climate right now as something that people try to make sense of, that making sense of happens through our brains. Everything that works in how we are understanding it as a problem, how we are understanding it as something that you can do something about, that's basically, that comes down to a question of how do our brains do this. And I became interested in that question about 10 years ago when I saw certain things happening in society. There were a number of scandals at the time. One of them was called ClimateGate, which the press got its hands on a number of email exchanges that had been between different scientists. Sentences were taken out of context, were put in a certain narrative, and it was made to sound as if the science wasn't clear or the science was very uncertain or was even saying the opposite of what at that time the scientists were saying, that it is a problem, it's happening, it's man-made, and so on and so forth. Oh. So I saw the science community, the climate science community and the policy communities reacting to that in a way where I thought, like, there's certain things that psychologists and neuroscientists know that it looks like these climate scientists don't know. And they're reacting through sort of like a common sense understanding of how you should be responding to this. Whereas actually there's knowledge in psychology and in neuroscience that can help you to understand that it would be more constructive to not do the things you're doing right now.
And ClimateGate, is that where the idea of like climate deniers comes from? Is that a thing? Is that what we call it, climate deniers? Or that, you know, the people that, like, I heard that there were loads of scientists that were basically saying, no, this is not a real thing.
I wouldn't call them many. There's actually very few working, maybe a bit more than four, but it's certainly not in the hundreds. Not hundreds of working climate scientists who are saying that nothing is happening or that humans don't contribute to it. So most scientists are saying that humans are mostly responsible for the changes we're seeing right now and are saying that there are pretty drastic changes happening. I prefer to call them climate skeptics. Mm-hmm. There isn't like a label for them that everyone will like. I do know that climate deniers is very antagonizing, makes some people really angry. And so I prefer to use the term that most of them like to use to describe their own positions. But it didn't originate with ClimateGate, but it certainly, that was one of the moments that increased the attention to that group of people who are saying, either nothing much is happening, or it's not man-made, or it's not very dangerous, whatever is happening.
Okay. And when, last question from you quickly, when did you start to care about climate change? Like, why was that something that, because I'm finding at the moment, like going through this process of like learning more about it, I'm like, oh no, this actually is something worth talking about, or we should be pushing these conversations more. But I'm really interested, if this started years ago for you, like what was the impetus? Like what was the moment where, because obviously you were studying to be a neuroscientist or being a neuroscientist, no?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of different moments along the way. And in 2008, there was a documentary on Channel 4 called The Great Global Warming Swindle. And it was a very polemic documentary, very much from the perspective of climate skeptics, bringing some of the few working scientists who still are climate skeptic into that fold. But I remember that I was watching it and I was very... it happened by accident. I was flicking through the channels like we were still doing in 2008. And I happened on this documentary and I started to watch it. And I very quickly became very angry because I was like, I don't recognize what they're saying. This doesn't look like it's true to me. Everything that they're saying about how the sun is responsible for this and it's not human contributions and so on and so forth. I wasn't recognizing any of that. Mm-hmm. But I recognized as a neuroscientist who knows a little bit about how brains work, that it would come across as very persuasive with people who perhaps had less of background knowledge about climate change or who knew less about how to find a climate scientist to go and ask them what is true about this documentary and so on and so forth. Mm. So I thought this is really persuasive, very misleading at the same time, was my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I did the one thing that I knew how to do, which is write to the scientists in the documentary. So as scientists, you know how to find other scientists and to write to them very respectful emails that say like, "Oh, I saw you in this documentary. Why did you say this particular thing?" And And that was kind of like, it's a point that we'll come back to afterwards, is that we all have these moments where we start doing something about climate change. And that was one of my key moments to do something. And it was from that anger of seeing that misleading stuff on screen, but then reacting in the one way that I knew how to react, which was write to other scientists. And interestingly, some of them got back to me. Actually, most of them got back to me because scientists are very polite to each other and they usually respond. And some of them were like, oh my gosh, I've been misled. They took what I said completely out of context. They edited the other way around of what I meant to say. And this wasn't, and I hadn't agreed to any of that.
Oh no, that's terrible.
But that was only a small minority of them, because there were quite a few other ones who said like, you know, it's not a perfect documentary. There are mistakes in there. And that was very interesting to see, even amongst the science community, these very different perspectives. And that was one of the key moments where I started to tie my sort of work as a neuroscientist together to the question of climate change.
Do you know what's really interesting about that is that I think I'm really, like, I think you've touched on something that's really important, which I'm often guilty of, is like whenever I disagree with someone, I assume they're an idiot. And I'm like, oh, you're like, you must be stupid to think something different to what I think. When actually, like, if you're inquisitive and you question people, generally they have, or most people have, like, a rational explanation behind why they think what they think, even if it's not necessarily what you agree with. Like, there is reasoning behind it. That's super interesting.
Yeah, indeed, that's the. And the thing that you just described, I tend to call that stupid, crazy, evil reasoning. And there's lots of reasons why we automatically fall into that when we're strongly disagreeing with people, because we're only holding positions because we believe that those positions are truthful. Therefore, people who disagree with us, we have to explain them. And we explain them by saying, you must be an idiot or you must be evil. You're believing the things that I'm believing, but actually you're doing that for your own benefits. Right. And you're just publicly, you're saying things differently. But in my perception, most people who will posit a position, who will take a position on something, actually do so because they really mean it and because they really believe it.
So obviously there are lots of directions we could take this conversation, given everything going on in the world. I'm not even going to mention them because they're not where we want to go, because I want to find out. You've been doing this, you've been applying your neuroscience research to climate change and the climate problem for, I would say, over a decade at the moment. And I want to understand how that's changed, because I think that there's been a massive change in awareness, in the way we talk about this problem. From your perspective, what's changed over that period of time?
You're absolutely right. So about 10 years ago, when I was looking at ClimateGate and these other issues, the main problem was the fault line between the people who accepted that there was a problem and those who said, no, there is no problem. There's nothing we should worry about. It's either not happening, or we're not contributing to it, or it's not going to be dangerous. That's sort of three separate positions that can be had in that skeptical on that skeptical side of the argument. And that was the main fault line that existed back then. In about 2013, I started to lecture about why is it that people hold these different positions? What are the psychological mechanisms behind that? Also then, like, about how do you then communicate across this divide? So 2018, things were still pretty much all right. But then we had this massive heat wave in the summer of 2018.
Right.
And that really was a big shift in how people were relating to climate change. Both XR and Greta Thunberg came actually out of that heat wave in 2018. Both movements were like, we've got to do something based on that sweltering heat that was across Europe at the time. So in sort of the autumn of 2018, you then had the first school strikes happening. You had XR coming into being. And at the start of 2019, when I needed to lecture about this again, I was like, I need to change my lectures. This isn't anymore about the division between people who think there isn't a problem and people who think there is a problem. The divisions are now really, the fault lines are starting to emerge between different groups of people who have different opinions about what the correct course of action is. And I remember at the start of 2019, in January, I had to make some slides, and my first slides were like, There's the yellow vests protest in Paris. There's the climate school strikes. There XR over here. And I remember saying to the students in that lecture, we're in the middle of an explosion. I don't know where this is going to go. But what I do know is that those fault lines from the previous years are not important anymore. And what is really changing now is the polarization around how we should deal with climate change, where some people think that we should overthrow capitalism and have a revolution and change the whole system. And other people are saying, no, we shouldn't do that. We don't have time for that. It's not going to work. We can't do that. We should try to work within the system. We should work with businesses, with finance, with politicians, not try to overthrow it. There are other fault lines where some people say, I think we need a carbon tax. And other people say, no, a carbon tax, that's never going to work. We need a cap and trade system. There's fault lines where people say, society isn't caring enough about this. We need to tell really scary messages about climate change. And other people who say, no, we shouldn't tell scary messages at all because it's not going to work. And so there's all of these different sort of courses of actions appearing where people start pursuing strong opinions that they have about what the right course of action is about climate change. And the risk of that fragmentation of the landscape of things that we have to do to tackle it is that there isn't a sort of a democratic mandate that is large enough to make any of these a reality. And that's kind of the problem and the challenge that I'm worried about at the moment.
So give me the democratic mandate line again, because I'm not sure that I understand what you're saying. So the risk is that there is not what?
So the risk is that these opinions, these strong opinions about what the correct course of action is to tackle climate change, that those strong opinions fragment so much that there's like 10% of the people who want the carbon tax and 10% who want the cap and trade system and 20% who want to overthrow capitalism. That means that there's not like that 50% or 60% or 70% of people that are behind something that can really make that change happen.
So essentially, a majority of people are saying something needs to change, but no one's agreeing on how to change it or like how to which way we're going to change whatever needs to change. Okay, yes,
exactly.
I get that.
Yeah, when you bring 20 people together who want things to change, you usually have 21 different opinions about how to bring about that change.
Yeah.
So here's a question then: is that a problem? Like,
it could and it could not be. Of course, there are certain policies that were. The majority of people will say, oh, this is a no-brainer, we should be doing this. So investing in renewable technologies is one of those things that can have very strong support. But on many other aspects, it could really be a problem if the fragmentation of opinion leads to a decision paralysis. If you, as a society, you can't make a decision because a fifth of your electorate is pursuing one position, another fifth is pursuing a second position, and so on and so forth. Then you just get like a battle about what the right decision is, and you don't get that decision being taken.
Right.
And there's something of that has been happening a little bit over the last few years. It's not even as strong as it could become. I fear that it could become stronger if there is a sense that not enough is happening about climate change, the tension in society between those who want to move really fast and those who want to move much slower is becoming much larger. That tension will become so large that there might not be any meaningful progress.
Okay. So then your work is in helping people, this is an assumption, correct me if I'm wrong, your work is in helping people who are sit at different points to understand each other or to be able to move to a space where they can make a decision.
Yes, and indeed, you capture that really nicely. It doesn't mean that you all need to be in agreement.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you need to understand that the course of action that you're pursuing and the course of action that I'm pursuing that they both might be leading to some greater goal.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that is one of the things that I'm working on, is sort of, we call that alignment, is creating alignment between people's understanding of what the correct course of action on climate change should be.
So here's a question about what that does, that fragmentation does, if you're not involved in the climate conversation. Like, I'm thinking, you know, Ben, this is a question for you. Like, do you feel, for example, that now that you are in this conversation, that maybe one of the reasons you didn't get involved in it is you're just not sure which direction to go in?
Yeah, there are, for me, on a personal level, there are way too many conflicting ideas, right? And I think, like, where the information comes from never feels solid. So I didn't have a great understanding of, like, what to do about cars or transportation, or what to do about recycling, or what to do about heat waves or forest fires or whatever. But I just knew that everything was a problem, and it becomes very overwhelming. And I feel like, for me, like, that stops me from engaging in the conversation in that way, because I just feel, it feels like the conversation is too big. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I recognize that so much in sort of the conversations that we have, is that there are groups of people who have strong opinions about what the correct course of action is, but there are many more people who are in your position, Ben, where they say, but what can I do? Mm. What can I do from the position that I'm in? Because I'm hearing all of these conflicting messages, and I don't know how I can get involved in that. The sort of one example is that I've been involved in some work with sort of farming and food production and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are strong disagreements of opinion between people who think that the correct answer to having a sustainable food supply is well cared for cows on well cared for pasture.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, contrast that with other people who will say, no, we shouldn't have any cows at all that are grazing and that are farting and producing greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. So there's both groups of people might be really dedicated to a better future for ourselves, one in which we're tackling climate change and biodiversity and all the other environmental problems we have. And yet they might be at loggerheads about the role of cows in that future.
Mm-hmm.
And that could distract them from moving forward, because they might end up in disagreement. But it then also is very confusing for people who look at that conversation and who go, like, but what do I need to make? How do I make sense of this conversation?
Because I find that confusing. Like, I think surely there's a right answer. Like, surely you, as Dr. Chris, must be thinking there is a correct way to do this, whether it's have the cows or don't have the cows. There's got to be one thing that's right. And if it, like, I get why people would be frustrated with that, right? Because you can't have half of the people saying, okay, no cows, and then another half of the people saying, well, we're just going to keep our cows over here, because those people will feel like the cow people are, sorry, it's such a weird analogy, but the non-cow people, the vegans will think that the cow people are causing more harm or more damage than is necessary. So how do you realistically move people then to a space where they can agree? Or you said it's not about agreement, so then do you just silo them off and let people do their own thing in, like, isolation?
So you touched on such an enormous amount of very interesting questions here at the heart of the climate change problem. And the first one is that it's not easy to come up with the right answer at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, to some degree, it really is the opinion that you attach to certain things, the value that you attach to certain things, that make you go to saying, I think we need to have cows on the land, or saying, no, we should all become vegan or vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going back to sort of like these brain processes that drive us in either direction. But the main reason why it's not important to say this is the right answer is because climate change is what is called a wicked problem,
mm-hmm.
meaning that it pervades everything. It pervades all of these decisions that we need to be making about food, about transport, about where we live, about how we go on holiday and all of that. about how we supply our energy and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that wicked problem, because it has so many facets to it, it has so many sides to it, it makes that our brains try to make sense of that by coming to these simple answers.
Yeah.
And so it's almost a cause for driving this fragmentation of opinion. It's a consequence of climate change being that wicked problem.
Right.
Because you're looking at the scale of the problem and you say, oh, I'm just going to focus on this particular thing. And I think that is the right course of action. Now, how do you then deal with that? How do you manage those differences of opinion is the other thing that you asked. So you don't just isolate them and say, you cow people go over there and you non-cow people go over there.
Yeah.
You can work in a way that you say, you know, we know that cars are contributing to greenhouse gas emissions.
Uh-huh.
We know that we're not growing them in the right way. We're eating too much of them. And we need to change those things. So there are two things that you can do.
Uh-huh.
You can say all of the current problems that we see in that car production, we can try to get rid of that. And we can try to go to a place where our cows are now better cared for. There's less of them. And that means that we might have to eat less of them, right? Yeah. And at the same time, you make a space for those people who say, we think that we should all become vegetarian. And individually, where you want to go as a person, you can say, well, I could be trying to be with the vegetarians,
mm-hmm.
or if that doesn't work, I can decide to buy only beef from well-cared-for cows on well-cared-for land.
Okay.
Even if it's going to be more expensive, I make that decision to eat a little bit less of it.
Yeah.
But to pay a little bit more for what I'm eating.
Which is important, right? Because both options are options.
Both options are options,
Which is definitely something I feel like I'm learning at the moment in terms of like my own impact. Like I think, oh, well, if you do like what I think the more that I start to understand the scale of the issue is the more I think, oh, well, I have to do something. It doesn't really matter what it is. And obviously it does matter because different things have different impacts. But as long as you're doing something or doing whatever you can do, surely that's better than doing nothing if the situation is really bad. Because I always look at like I was having this conversation with one of my friends at the weekend, and we were chatting about, I was saying, oh, I'm doing this podcast and it's on climate change. I'm learning loads of stuff. And she was saying, oh, I work for a company that does stuff around electric cars and raising awareness and campaigning and that kind of stuff. And I had no idea that she did that kind of work. But she was saying, in her work, like part of her feels like there's no point even talking about this until the oil barons start changing what they're doing, or until these people do something about this, or until that person does something about that. Which is also that really resonates with me. Like I do think, there are people that are having a much larger impact, than the impact that I can possibly make. But I guess it's important to do your bit. Whatever that looks like, whether it's eating no cows or clean cows. Clean cows.
I like that one. But you're again, you touched on one of those aspects of wicked problems, is that they often lead us to sit in our little corners and to say, no, we should wait for other people to do something first, because in the position where I am, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
And those oil barons, we've actually, in conversations that we've had with some of them or with people who work with them, they are sitting in that position. Some of them say, well, we know that climate change is a problem, but we're waiting for consumers to send the signal that we need to change.
Wow.
And others say, you know, we know that climate change is a problem, but we don't feel that we can do much because our investors are looking over our shoulder and want us to maximize our profit. They don't want us to be thinking about climate change too much.
Mm-hmm.
So even those people in that context are going, but what can I do?
Mm.
So businesses are waiting for governments to set regulations. They're also waiting for consumers to tell them what to do. Right. Politicians are waiting for citizens to tell them what new regulations to bring in, and citizens are waiting for governments to tell them to take action and to tell them what to do. So we're all sort of just sitting there and waiting and looking, staring at each other and getting really upset for why the idiots on the other side aren't doing what they should be doing.
So I have a question about this, because listening to you talk, I want to understand something about why this happens, because some of the climate people that, you know, I've had the luxury of speaking to have told me, look, we know what we need to do. We're not looking for some silver bullet. We don't need to invent new tech. We don't need even to like write a new policy. It's been written. Like, we know what it is, but we just need to do it. And so how does that point of view or that belief kind of work with this idea that people are just pointing fingers and saying, well, you have to go first, not me?
So that's an excellent question. And it's really, it's true that there are sizable groups of people who say that they know what we have to do, but often that doesn't tell us how we have to do things. In psychology, there's a term called agency, which is knowing how to act. Mm-hmm. And on climate change, most of us are not having the agency right now to try to bring about the things that we know we have to do.
So what's the what for you is the next step? If you can do one thing, here's one thing you can do. How do you do that work? Do you spend your time talking to individuals, or do you spend your time working with organizations or companies or institutions, or like, how does that work practically for you?
It's about doing less consumption.
Right.
And we're not thinking about all of the other ways that we could act on climate change. And actually, I would say that you doing this podcast is your climate action.
Okay. Thank you. It's a relief.
it's potentially a much bigger thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time when we're dealing with that agency, with that knowing how to act, we are developing methods to allow people to discover their sense of agency that works with who they are as an individual, as a member of a certain organization, or as a member of what we call a community of practice, which is a group of people who works in a certain way. Uh-huh. Doctors, farmers, people working in local councils. So all of these roles, these job roles almost, they come with a certain agency. You know how to do certain things.
Right.
And what is lacking at the moment is the understanding of how do you bring climate change or action on climate change into the agency that you already have. And I would say that you as a podcast host, you've discovered it. You've started to do this podcast with Mariam, and that's your agency speaking. Just like when I wrote to the scientist in 2008, I knew how to write to scientists. That was my climate action at that moment.
Yeah.
And so we need to really enlarge that scope of how we think about climate action. It's not only about the things that you do to reduce your own carbon footprint. It's about how do you try to bring us, the whole of society, onto this transition where we think about climate change not as a threat that is going to kill us all, but as something that we are tackling with all of our might, as a group of people, as a society. And so there's all of these different roles that we're having where we could bring thinking about climate change into our professional identity, into the things that we're passionate about, right, as citizens, and so on and so forth.
That's such a cool way of thinking about it. Like, I grew up in church, and I always used to, like, I remember so clearly as a kid, like, thinking, why are we doing Lent? Like, what is this thing? Why do I have to give up chocolate for a month? It doesn't make any sense. And I think, like, it's like I've definitely seen climate action as giving up things, or like not doing this, not doing that, getting rid of this, getting rid of that, as opposed to using the skills or the abilities that I have in the world to influence the conversation or move the conversation forward. That's such a cool way of looking at it. So it really is about agency, isn't it?
Well, you know that I love this. I think this is so important now. And I want to ask this question around, so you're helping people go on this journey of discovery of how do they do this, right? And I know that you've developed some insights into this, and I'm wondering whether there's one or two you want to share with us that you think might kind of shake us out of maybe some misconceptions we have as Ben, me, and everyone listening.
Yeah, so the most important one there is one that I call actions drive beliefs. And it really sort of drives coach and horses through the conventional wisdom that we all have most of the time, which is that our beliefs and our concerns and our awareness about things drive the behavior and the actions that we do. And that's to a degree that's true. When we have very strong opinions about something, our actions will usually be in line with our opinions. So you wouldn't glue yourself to Waterloo Bridge as an XR activist if you weren't absolutely convinced that climate change was a big problem.
Right.
So in that sense, it works. But when you don't have a strong opinion or when you don't know what it is that you should be doing, it is actually awareness and concern and beliefs can't drive any action because you don't know how to turn it into action. So what you have to do then is you've got to go on a journey where you allow your actions to change your understanding and beliefs of a thing. And that's because once we do, when we are in a position where we don't have a strong opinion or we're struggling to solve a problem, once we do that first action, not only does it take us to a new place, something, a place where we weren't before, we've now changed something in our house, for instance, or we've changed something in our job or whatever, that we hadn't done before, but also our brains usually start justifying the step we have just taken. And that justification, it can have lots of negative consequences. It can lead people into very entrenched positions where they become very polarized from other people. That's a negative version of it. But in the positive version, it actually amounts to that development of agency. By taking that first step and saying, you know what, I don't know fully how this is going to play out, but I am going to be doing this, that then gives you more insight in how to take the next action.
Do you think that then in a way, if you were trying to change the beliefs of the people around you, the way you get them to change those beliefs isn't by having conversations with them about why they're wrong or right. Like, it's actually about getting them to do something that influences the way they think.
Yes. So there are two ways that you can do this. There are two ways that you can create this opportunity for people to develop their own agency. And the first one is to create opportunities for those people to start taking actions. The most important thing you have to do for that to work is listen. Listen to who they are. Listen to what they care about. Listen to how they could take that first step themselves. And the second thing that you can do is you can talk about the things that you're doing. You can talk about your actions that you're taking. Because what we're very good at in that development of agency is learning from how other people develop agency. Mm-hmm. It's called social learning in some branches of psychology. And people are just very good at that, at seeing someone else learn from experience and that applying them to their own lives. So what is happening a lot in this communication of climate action at the moment is that people are communicating like menus. They're communicating, these are the 10 things you should be doing. Drive less, eat less meat, fly less, da da da. And instead of that, we should have recipes and cookbooks and cooking classes, not menus. Mm. We should really help people to discover how do you do this. Because it's we all know that if we fly less, that we then will have less of a carbon footprint. And some people manage to take that step, but others can't. And sometimes that's because they've got family on different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And now you're stuck between your concern about climate change and the value you put in family and friendship, where you want to go and see your family and friends once in a while to maintain that bond with them. So those kinds of conflicts that people have internally between the different things they care about sometimes leads them to get really stuck and saying, you know, I don't know what to do here. I can't resolve this discrepancy between not flying and seeing my mom, and therefore I'm not going to care about climate change.
Mm.
So in order to prevent that from happening, you really need to then allow people to discover these other forms of agency that we could be working on. So that could be a form of action on climate change, is to say, you know, I can't resolve this discrepancy, but I'm going to try to do this thing over there, mm-hmm. which will contribute to that big shift that society needs to take.
I mean, that's so encouraging.
Yeah, that's like literally the most encouraging message I've heard, you know, because I think it then means that it's not about a blame game. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like that's what makes the conversation really inaccessible. Particularly for people, like you say, who are in positions where the life that they have to live isn't conducive with what those menus of climate action say. So if you're somebody who can't afford to buy organic food from Waitrose or from Whole Foods or whatever, and you actually just have to buy whatever you can afford to buy from Iceland or Sainsbury's, then like, yeah, you're probably not going to care about climate change. But if we change the way that we're talking about how those people can engage with the issues, then they'll be more excited to do that.
I was going to ask something, because, and this may be wrong, it may not be the right, not, well, there is one right, but I just want to, so I find these action lists really off-putting for climate, and I'm engaged, but and it's almost like I know what I need to do. That is that why? Is it because these action lists are kind of the end, what they're doing is giving you the end piece, rather than telling you how to get from where you are to where you need to be? And then it's not that it's the lists that's problematic, it's that the way that they're conceptualized don't like allow people to see their own journey in it.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. So for that process of actions drive beliefs to really work, the actions that you see or that you're thinking about or that you're engaging in need to be doable.
So I wanna ask a vision question that we ask all of our guests, and I've been thinking about these, and I've been like, oh, are these the right questions for Chris, given everything I've learned? But I'm gonna ask them, and we'll see where we go. Let's say we do everything we need to do over the next 10 years when it comes to climate. What do you think the world is going to look like and be like?
That's a really interesting question. And it's actually, I just finished writing a paper with a couple of other people about some of that actions drive belief stuff and all of that. And we start with a visioning. We start with like, this is how the world is going to look in 2030 if we are really taking this serious. And my vision is for that time of we're in a world where climate change, it's still there. It hasn't resolved, because it's not going to be resolved that quickly, but it's not anymore the thing that is really observed as incredibly threatening and as something that's going to kill us all. And so rather than an issue, it becomes something that we know how to act on. And that means that as a society, we'll be engaged in all of those actions, but also there will be a buzz in sort of media and the journalism about this that isn't anymore about, look how bad things are. It's about, this is what we're doing about this.
Mm.
So the story will be about, this is what we are doing. And there will be stories that are relevant to all of us in our particular context, to farmers, to health professionals, to investment managers, to city planners. All of us need those positive examples of how we act on it. There will be sort of like a sense of like, yes, we're doing this, we're tackling this, we're getting this, we're gonna get through this. Hopefully, rather than thinking about it as problems, we'll think about it as things that we're trying to resolve.
Mm. I mean, it's quite amazing to be able to give yourself permission to think about this as not an existential threat. you know, like imagining a world where this is just one of the things that we are dealing with and we know how to deal. Like it's like managing something rather than feeling like it's the end of you. That's quite quite amazing.
Yeah.
It just think about that in the all the other areas in life where things could be a threat, but you're not thinking about them as threats. If you don't eat, you will die. You will starve to death from hunger. Are we ever thinking about not eating? No, we're celebrating good food. We enjoy it. We spend time on it. We have cooking shows. We've got cooking celebrities, all of that stuff. Traffic is very deadly. Are we constantly worried about how deadly traffic is? No, we're thinking about how we can keep ourselves safe.
Yeah.
And that's because in all of these domains, we've got agency. We know what to do about that situation. When it comes to climate change, we don't have that sense of agency. Therefore, it feels threatening. But if we develop that sense of agency, the threat will become less. So I very rarely feel overwhelmed by the threats of climate change, even though I know how bad things could be if we don't resolve it. But it doesn't overwhelm me because I have this enormous sense of knowing that I have to do something about it, and knowing that what I'm trying to do could make a difference. Mm. So that's how I deal with that particular thing.
Yeah. And I guess that's really interesting, like the reframing of how we see what you described as wicked problems, right? So it is like a big release to not have to think of it as like existential crisis, but rather like crisis management. The other question, which I think you've alluded to in parts, but is how it, if for the people that are listening to this podcast, so the people that are at home, everyday people, average Joes, what can they do about climate change?
It's to try and go on that journey of discovery of your own agency. And if that is to, that's something that's not easily done alone by yourself individually. So we need to form community for that. We need to find people who want to go on a similar journey with ourselves. But the important thing is that journey comes from or starts from the things you already know how to do, or the things you're already doing, and then build up from there and say, how can I tie in the things that I'm already doing with dealing with this thing called climate change? It sounds kind of abstract, but think about it through the lens of who you are as a person.
Dr. Chris, that's such a good answer. That's such a good answer. And I think it's really true. And like on a really personal level, again, like that's definitely been my experience of like being involved in this podcast has been like, I feel like I've been grafted into a little community of change where like people are like, oh, we need to do this. And I was like, I don't know anything about this. And now it feels like I'm doing something, which is cool. I think it, like seeing it through the lens of who you are as an individual is a really important part of that, which requires thinking. And I think that's the hard bit, is it requires actual work. Do you know what I mean? I think that's why people opt in for the menu way of doing it, because you just know somebody's told you exactly what you need to do and it's your choice whether you do it or not. You have to do very much thinking about it.
You know, Ben, can I just say the other thing I think is interesting about this, about what you said, Chris, as well, and I was thinking in relation to you, Ben, is this idea of it's hard to do it alone. Do you know, I find that sometimes other people see what you're good at much more clearly than you see what you're good at. So I remember, Ben, when I approached you to host this with me, you were like, I love you. I'm paraphrasing you. You know, things like this. But, you know, you were like, I love hosting. I love doing this. Yeah, but I don't know anything about climate. Am I the right person? And it was quite interesting because for me, it was obvious. And so this idea that maybe sometimes other people can see that role that you can play more clearly than yourself, I really like. I really like.
Yeah.
So let's move on to our fun, final, essential segment.
Climate Confessions. And now it's time for our Climate Confessions. Let's fess up to the bad habits we just can't kick.
So, for those of you who have not been listening for the last few weeks, Climate Confessions is where we get to ask our esteemed guest to tell us what they are kind of crap at when it comes to climate. And in the process, Ben and I get to reveal far too much about ourselves. So, Chris, do you want to go first? Do you know? Do you have your confession ready?
I do. Ooh. And it's going to be a slightly unusual one because, again, I was thinking about that, like, what is the thing I'm not good at? And I was thinking, can I move away from that sort of personal carbon footprinty thing? Because I'm actually doing quite well on a lot of those things. Not perfectly, but I'm doing all right. And I was thinking the one thing that I'm really crap at is that before COVID struck, when we were still seeing people in the real world, I often found myself sitting in a cafe or a place where I was doing some work or doing some reading and then listening in the background at a conversation where a group of people was talking about something. And I remember one in particular where a large group of women were talking about the travels they had just been on. And I was thinking, like, I so really want to go and talk to this group and ask them what they think about climate change. Not going over and saying you shouldn't have flown and you shouldn't have gone a ski holiday to south of France last week. That was not the thing I was trying to do. But I really just wanted to go over and to say, you know, how do you guys think or feel about climate change? And I've had that several times where I heard groups of people speak about a certain thing. And I was like, I want to know what they think about climate change. And I never do it. And I wish I could.
Oh, I like this. This is like a whole different kind of confession. This is great, Chris, because everyone else has talked about the things they want to stop doing. And you're telling us about the things you want to start doing. I love it. Yeah. I love it. Ben, this is fantastic. Can we think of any that are in that vein?
I definitely can't. I feel like my answer is everything. Like, I feel like I don't do anything at all. So I need to start doing everything.
So Chris, that's fascinating. I love that. You've set a new tone for the confessional. But Ben, I want to know what yours is because I know you've been thinking about it.
Yeah. And you actually are doing the thing that you said that people should do in the podcast, which is important. But my thing is,
thank you. You've increased my agency here enormously. Thank you. Sorry.
No, it's good. My climate confession today is that I do not separate my recycling. And I've actually feel really bad for doing this, but especially if it's raining, like I don't separate the papers and the plastics. I just put them all in the same thing, which I from my understanding renders the whole process useless, right? Like I might as well have just put it in the normal bin. But that is the truth. I don't do it all the time. Like I try to separate it, but sometimes it's just too long or like you're running out the door or the like recycling bins are coming, like the rubbish collection people are coming and you just have to do it quick. So I don't always do it and I will do better. Or maybe I won't.
You need to come live where I live. I don't have to separate my recycling.
Why? Do they do it for you?
Yeah, but then doesn't that make you just think that it all just ends up in landfill anyway?
Yeah. They do it for you in inverted commas. Right.
So I am actually going to go with a confession that is themed to Chris's work. Because I was thinking about your TEDx London talk, Chris, and about actually something that came up today, interestingly, about Ben, you said earlier about how when people disagree with you, you just think, oh, they're idiots.
Yeah.
That's my confession. My confession is that when we talk about, and I'll use the language that they want, when we talk about climate skeptics, my ultimate kind of judgment is that they just must not be very smart. And I know because I've got to work with you, Chris, and a few others in this field that is not helpful. So that's my climate confession, actually, is the thing I want to fight, is that judgment I have of others. Mm. It's been wonderful talking to you. And as always, blowing my mind, blowing like my view of the world and helping me be, I feel like a better human after I speak to you.
Yeah, like for me, that's definitely what I've got from it is like you can, that care about this stuff and do this work and not be an asshole about it. Like, I feel like the way that you like perceive the other people's thought is like a really important like model for how to do this kind of work for me. And that's really encouraging. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, this was so fun.
Okay, Ben. So let's check in on your optimistic meter. How are you feeling now?
My optimeter is going up. I feel good. I feel like I've reached a plateau now of feeling, to steal from Dr. Chris, feeling like I have agency in climate action. Like, I feel like I've reached a point of thinking I can do something about this. And it doesn't feel overwhelming. I think the scale of the issue still feels like massive. And I'm still interested to like delve a bit more into like the specifics of what things actually mean, but it feels good. Like, it feels manageable, which is nice.
That's good. I hope people who've been following us over the last few episodes are feeling the same. I'm going to say I've been super excited to speak to everyone so far, and we've got some very exciting guests coming up over the next few weeks.
Scorches.
So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Stay curious. Thanks for joining us this week. If you enjoyed what you listened to today, please rate and subscribe and share the episode with a curious friend. Join the conversation on socials using the hashtag ClimateCuriousPod and let us know what you want to hear about next time. You can find us online at TEDx London.
This podcast was made possible by TEDx London's headline partner, City. City is all about progress and supporting great ideas. And for the past 5 years, they've supported us to bring world-changing ideas to the TEDx London stage. Now they're taking it to the next level by supporting this new podcast. Thanks, City. This episode was produced by Josie Coulter, curation and research by Tara Cooper, engineered and mixed by Ben Beheshti, artwork designed by Sabrina Russo and Rebecca Mingus, music composed by Ben the Falcon Beheshti, presented by Marion Pasha and Ben Hurst.